This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
this is really an incredible story, and it really reveals the bureaucratic problems that go with these rescues. The Italian authorities decided to allow the 105 migrants to land in Italy after this ordeal that basically kept them at sea while the Italians were arguing with the British government about who was responsible and who would take control of the situation.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. We'll have full details on the story coming up.
Also, Burundi bans two major international broadcasters just days ahead of a referendum on constitutional amendments. And the International Monetary Fund says financial growth in sub-Saharan Africa is projected to pick up modestly this year.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Burundi has announced a six-month ban on broadcasts by Voice of America and the BBC 2 weeks before the country votes on proposed amendments to the constitution, including changes in presidential term limits. The ban was announced last Friday by Burundi's National Communication Council, which accused VOA and the BBC of breaching laws regulating the media and engaging in unethical conduct. We have in studio VOA reporter Eddie Ruema from the Central Africa Service to shed light on the matter. Seems like there is a war declared on the media. What's going on in Burundi?
Well, I would say that this is not surprising. It's not the first time that Burundi is suspending independent and private media. Yeah, this happened in 2015, right at the beginning of the political crisis in Burundi, when Burundi banned five local private media radio stations. So to us, I believe this happens just 2 days into the referendum campaign. So I believe that one of the reasons, maybe that's what many people are talking about right now, it's a way of stopping the world to really understand what is going on in Burundi right now. When we talk of the referendum campaigns, we've received numerous reports from the opposition who are campaigning for a no vote, who have not been allowed to campaign. Most of their supporters are being intimidated. Most of them have been imprisoned. Just yesterday, we spoke to one of the opposition leaders who said that 23 of their members were arrested just yesterday. So it's a way of probably not letting the world know exactly what is happening in our country.
In a statement last Friday, VOA Director Amanda Bennett, of course, denounced the council's action, saying the ban deprives the citizens of Burundi of a trusted news source during a critical time in the country. And the U.S. State Department has also said the U.S. is disappointed with the actions of Burundi and has raised those concerns directly with the government. Are you aware of any response on the ban from Burundi's government?
The Burundian government itself has not come out to say why and why not they imposed these sanctions on us, but the head of the National Communications Council, like you laid out some of the accusations, said these are things that if VOA and the CNC can meet together, they can try to find a solution to this. But again, if you remember in 2015 during the political crisis, VOA increased its programming in Kirundi and Kinyarwanda right after the government had banned all the other stations to basically fill the void that had been left by the private media. And one thing we had seen is the increment of our listenership. Right now, we are getting floods of messages from Burundians who are saying that they've been left in the dark. So we haven't heard anything from the government, but I know that the U.S. government, State Department, the U.S. Embassy in Burundi, they're trying to see how this situation could be reversed.
Thank you for your input, Eddie Ruema from VOA's Central Africa Service.
Thank you very much.
...105 migrants stranded in the Mediterranean for nearly 3 days finally reached land last night in Rome. The migrants were rescued from a vessel in distress off the coast of Libya. However, they were kept at sea as Italy and the UK bickered over who should take them in. Reporter Josephine McKenna is covering this latest migrant situation and provides us with details.
This is really an incredible story, and it really reveals the bureaucratic problems that go with these rescues. The Italian authorities decided to allow the 105 migrants to land in Italy after this ordeal that basically kept them at sea while the Italians were arguing with the British government about who was responsible and who would take control of the situation. Now, this was the second time in as many months that Italy has delayed allowing rescued migrants to move forward because of bureaucratic wrangling. And some people even believe that this is a strategy to dissuade aid groups from rescuing migrants.
What is each side saying? What is the UK saying?
Well, the UK is saying that it was not responsible for this situation. What we saw was on Sunday morning, the Italian Coast Guard reported a vessel in distress off the coast of Libya to a boat that was being operated by the Spanish NGO Proactiva Open Arms, and they alerted the Libyan Coast Guard. The Libyan Coast Guard didn't show up, and so this Proactiva ship, the Astral, decided to step in and save the migrants. But while they were waiting for a larger vessel to come along, a rescue ship run by Doctors Without Borders, it became a complicated situation because both rescue ships were flying a British flag and said that they were waiting for authorization from the British government for this transfer. The UK, though, said it wasn't coordinating the rescue and it wasn't responsible. So you can see how this just completely got bogged down, and the migrants were in a very difficult situation, many of them, you can imagine, in psychological and physical distress while they were waiting for a decision.
Where are the migrants mostly from?
We didn't have an indication of where they were from, many from different African countries, but I'm not sure which specifically. The main concern was to protect their health and safety. Finally, the Italian Coast Guard stepped in and decided to take a decision, and they have been brought to safety in Italy. There has been quite an outcry about this, and Luigi Manconi, who is the head of the Italian Senate's Human Rights Commission, said today that it was outrageous that the Libyan Coast Guard simply didn't show up, that the migrants were kept in a situation of extreme danger for 36 hours, and that it really indicated the kind of chaos that we're seeing in the Mediterranean over the fate of many, many migrants.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Nigeria's government has given no further details about the more than 1,000 Boko Haram hostages that the army says it rescued. Yesterday, the military used Twitter to announce it had rescued the people from the villages of Amachaka, Gora, Malamakari, and Walasa in the Bama region of Borno State. In the tweets, it said the women, children, and young men were being cared for in a hospital. Today, Nigerian news media had little coverage on the report. Military officials have not taken telephone calls from VOA's Hausa service seeking more details. The military says its 22nd Brigade worked with the multinational joint task force to rescue the hostages. The task force includes troops from Benin, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria. Boko Haram, a hardline Islamist group, has waged the battle for territory in northeastern Nigeria for 9 years. Thousands of people have been killed in attacks. Thousands have been kidnapped, including hundreds of young women forced to marry militants.
The International Monetary Fund says financial growth in sub-Saharan Africa is projected to pick up modestly this year. But the IMF also warns that 15 of the region's 35 low-income countries are either in debt distress or at risk of it. So paying off their loans is cutting into their budgets and diverting resources from health, education, and infrastructure. The regional outlook says the average growth rate for the region should range from 2 2/3% to 3.5%. Some faster-growing countries like Ivory Coast, Ethiopia, Ghana, and Senegal are forecast to keep growth robust at 6%. Anything below 4% undercuts development goals that were set 5 years ago. Abebe Embro Selassie, director of the IMF's Africa Department, says vulnerabilities are rising in countries that have yet to implement fiscal reforms. He urges raising tax revenues to bolster private investment and make critical spending on infrastructure and social services. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib. 16 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Burundi bans two major international broadcasters just days ahead of a referendum on constitutional amendments. And the International Monetary Fund says financial growth in sub-Saharan Africa is projected to pick up modestly this year. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Cape Town's had good rains recently, but not enough to break one of the most serious droughts that the South African city has ever experienced. The heavy rains that usually fall in the region in winter have failed to happen for the past 3 years, and Cape Town's reservoirs are historically at low levels. The city council is asking residents to each use no more than 50 liters of water a day. The stringent restrictions mean many Cape Townians are constantly scurrying around for extra water, including at one of their city's iconic landmarks, Darren Taylor reports.
The people of Cape Town have been harvesting water in Spring Road in the leafy suburb of Newlands for centuries. Despite the drought, the spring water hasn't stopped flowing down nearby Table Mountain. Grey metal pipes channel it into collectors' containers. The water crisis means the queues here have never been so long. A variety of Cape Townians form a long line on a crisp autumn morning. There are armed security guards and nurses from a nearby hospital, school children, housewives, and businessmen in smart suits. They're all very different, but all united in their quest for the fountain's riches. A man in a tattered red cap drags a 25-liter plastic canister to his rusted car. Leon Fernandez's white and brown checked shirt is streaked with sweat. The pensioner says he's probably too old to be carrying such heavy loads, but the Newlands Spring is an institution, and he can't resist its fresh, sweet water.
Our Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, God, we are sinners, and we ask you to forgive us. There's only one God.
A man with a long white beard prays at the fountain. Sadiq Ibrahim, an imam, or Muslim leader, is fetching water for his mosque.
So this is very, very good water, and it's flowing for nothing. It's free.
Sadiq believes the drought is a punishment from God.
We are doing too much sin, too much crime, you understand? And God is not happy. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not happy. There's no unity. Whether you're white, black or pink, we are not working together.
The imam says God is angry with Cape Town because the city that once boasted one of the highest rainfalls in southern Africa has taken his gift of water for granted.
There's enough water for the whole world, as long as they don't waste the water. Now, Islam teaches you, don't waste the water.
There are rumors that should the winter rains fail for a fourth year, the authorities will shut the spring to the public and take control of its water. If this happens, says Sadiq, the Muslim community will rise in outrage.
Most of these guys, you see, is Muslims. Why are they? Because we as Muslims, we can't just go into church. We have to wash ourselves five times a day before our prayer. So this water is very, very important to us. God bless you, brother.
Sadiq thanks a man for helping him to pile tankards into the trunk of his car. Nearby, a young man in a floppy neon yellow hat and bright orange reflective vest crunches a plastic bottle so that it'll fit on his cart. Vogan Engelbrecht's clothing identifies him as one of the men who found employment here, assisting the crowds of water collectors.
Some of them got lots of cans and they can't carry that stuff. They need trolleys. So we offer our help to them. We're helping old ladies also that don't like to carry the heavy stuff.
Engelbrecht arrived at the fountain a few months ago, soon after the municipality began enforcing severe water restrictions.
Yes, it's tough work, but you know, the tubs they're giving you, it's a nice run. If you go hard, all out.
Previously unemployed and languishing in Cape Town's impoverished Delft area, he says he's grateful for the 300 rand or $25 he earns at the spring on an average day. Engelbrecht's muscles swell as he delivers another cargo and pushes his trolley back to the spring.
I'm here because this is also the job. It's fitness for me also. I like this job. It's great to like meet people every day and then you make a lot of friends, you know.
But he says there's sometimes tension between him and his fellow water carriers and other men who want their jobs.
At first, we were nice here. Just a few, 6-5. But as the time goes on, some of the new faces come and just help some people, and we don't like them.
Police officers now patrol the fountain, but Engelbrecht's confident they won't be here for much longer, because soon, he declares, the drought will be over and the pressure on the spring will ease.
I have a strong feeling it's going to rain.
But then it's going to put you out of job.
No, you're still going to need water. Yeah.
And he says they'll get that from the Newland Spring, because it isn't just a water source, but a place where the city's rich and poor become equal, if only for fleeting moments. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Cape Town.
The Liberian government is under pressure to strengthen press freedoms. This after the Committee to Protect Journalists called for reform of the country's libel laws. The development comes after President George Weah accused BBC correspondent Jonathan Peleli of undermining his humanitarian efforts with compromising coverage of Liberia's civil conflict. It also comes after staff members of Front Page Africa, a local newspaper, were briefly arrested over a dispute about an advertisement that was published in the paper. It was rumored that the arrests were a thinly veiled attack from the Weah administration for Front Page's critical reporting. In Monrovia, reporter Monique Joan asked Peter Kouakoua, the president of the West African Journalist Association, to explain the current challenges to press freedom in the region.
There have been very many issues almost coming together, and that would appear like a very serious misunderstanding that have occurred between the president and the media. First with the issue of Jonathan. And we are glad that Jonathan has returned to Liberia, and he said he didn't go to seek asylum. So that clarifies the earlier belief that he fled the country, because I was personally concerned about that. But we are grateful because we haven't had that kind of situation for a very long time since the end of the conflict.
Can you tell me really exactly what are the libel laws that the administration and journalists here need to be aware of?
Well, I mean, the issue of the libel laws have been here for a very long time, and we were grateful to have Madam President Sirleaf sign on to Table Mountain efforts to remove those laws started in earnest by the president and the media, but it didn't come to anything until late in her administration. She introduced a law in Parliament. It was submitted to Parliament, and Parliament brought it to floor, but no action was taken on it. So the laws are there. And those laws, for me, are like a trap, you know, that government has set. Many a times they will say the laws are stay on the books. My argument have been, if you believe that those laws should not exist, it doesn't make sense to charge journalists with criminal libel. We are hoping that the new government, Mr. George Weah, will pay some attention to this, because it's a leftover issue that we cannot afford to go sleeping on. First, there's a law on sedition. There is one on what they call criminal libel against the president, and then one that is specifically referred to as criminal malevolence. These are all official restrictions on what the media can and cannot do. We have also been very keen on the government relinquishing the state radio. The state radio remains an instrument used exclusively for the executive. It is our hope that it can be transformed into a public service broadcaster so that it serves the good of not only the government of the day, but that it can be an instrument used to advance and enable the media space, especially for the democratic governance of the country.
Aside from helping improve those operations and reforming libel laws, can you think of other things that would help enhance press freedom here and maybe even West Africa in general?
But we have also been working around establishing an independent broadcast regulator. That remains a very important instrument that we need to look at, because there's got to be transparency in the allocation of frequency and regulation of the sector. That hasn't been, as far as I'm aware. I also know that there are efforts, talking about West Africa, there are efforts in other countries to repeal criminal defamation. I know there have been efforts underway in Benin. There have been efforts in Sierra Leone to repeal their laws. In Burkina Faso, there is a regional effort in showing that we have all these laws that speak to repression, you know, of the media are removed. And I think it is in the interest of every government that want to be seen as a democratic government to make some efforts to relax laws that are very repressive in the operation of the media.
That was Peter Kwakwa, the president of the West African Journalist Association, speaking to Monique Joan in Monrovia. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Linus Rimkus, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga have agreed to end their political animosity. A discussion on Kenyan politics on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.